Madam Chair, Commissioners, LERC staff, my name is Christine Cinnamon. I'm the Environmental Manager with TransCanada working on the Kibby Expansion Project. With me today is Dana Valu, an Environmental Specialist with TRC, who headed up the environmental permitting and field survey efforts, and both of us worked on the Kibby Project as well. With me also is Don Hudson, who's going to speak to us about subalpine fir, and Peter Vickery, who will talk to us about Bicknell's thrush. Sure. Try to move it a bit closer. The details of our studies and results and analysis is all contained in our pre-filed testimony as well as our application material. I'm not going to go into that detail today. Instead, I'd like to focus on a few key points. The first point I'd like to make is just to confirm our commitment to avoid and minimize impact to the greatest extent possible. This has not changed from our approach on the Kibby project. It is the exact same approach that we used both on Kibby and the Akibby expansion project. This is contrary to Dave Publicover's testimony, in which a statement was made that perhaps the standard was weaker, and I'd like to just reconfirm that commitment to you that it has not changed. We worked very closely in coordination with all of the relevant agencies in developing our survey protocols as well as in the presentation of results and then citing project elements to, as I said, avoid and minimize impact to the greatest extent possible. And this is a very important point for us because it is the agencies that that give the final test as to undue adverse impact. And so it's important that they get the information they need and are comfortable with our information to ensure that that is the case. First area I'd like to focus on is relative to bog lemming habitat. What you see on the screen there is the overall project layout. There are three purple areas that were identified as potential bog lemming habitat. I'd like to focus in a little bit closer with the next slide. And this shows that we were able to site the project elements to completely avoid that bog lemming habitat as well as the upland areas associated with that habitat. This is the same as what we did on Kibby. The next area I'd like to talk about is Roaring Brook mayfly, spring salamander, vernal pools, and wetlands. We understood early on in developing the project that there was the potential for habitat for spring salamander and Roaring Brook mayfly. We worked with the agencies to survey the area. We did not find Roaring Brook mayfly or spring salamander. Despite that, we implemented draft IF&W guidance to protect those potential areas despite the fact that we did not find them there. I'd like to address a comment in Ms. Burrito's pre-filed testimony relative to vernal pools. There was an assertion that we did not use the appropriate protocol. In fact, we did use the appropriate protocol to identify potential vernal pools. In Maine, the season, the spring season for identifying vernal pools is quite short. IF&W understands this, and therefore they have a standard protocol to use to identify vernal pools or potential vernal pools outside of that season. That's the protocol that we used. We identified potential vernal pools. The ones we identified are all man-made. That is, they are non-jurisdictional, not state-regulated. Despite that, again, we treated them as though they were state-regulated and applied the appropriate buffer zones according to that to protect those potential vernal pool areas. And with respect to wetlands, we did wetland surveys the same manner in which we did we surveyed the Kibby area, and we used the results of those surveys to site project elements to avoid and minimize wetlands to the greatest extent possible. Permanent fill impacts end up being less than 1 acre. The vast majority of that is associated with improving the existing Mile 5 road hydrology. So those improvements are going to be good for that road. Next, I'd like to talk about avian and bat survey data. Briefly, I'd like to address the statement by Ms. Gallo in her pre-filed testimony that suggested that passage rates were somewhat higher and flight heights somewhat lower than in other projects such as Kibby. In fact, if you look at the data presented for the Kibby expansion project, passage rates are quite comparable, as are the flight heights that we recorded, and in many cases are lower than what we see in other projects in Maine, including those that have been permitted, such as Kibby. And despite the fact that I trust that this data is sound based on the experts that we have hired to do the surveys and present the results, the final test of this, again, is the feedback from agencies to ensure there is no undue adverse impact. The next slide that we have up here is relative to the Bicknell thrush habitat. Again, we worked very closely with IF&W to ensure that our survey effort was robust. We identified breeding Bicknell thrush habitat on CISC. If we could zoom in, what you can see here is in the red hatched area, two areas of core breeding habitat, and the yellow outline, it's a little bit hard to see, indicates a larger or broader potential habitat that we identified. We worked with the agencies to site project elements to avoid and minimize, so avoiding the core habitat and minimizing the impact of potential Bicknell thrush habitat. Peter Vickery is going to talk to you in greater detail about Bicknell thrush in a little bit. And the final set of slides and point that I would like to talk about is subalpine fir habitat. You can see here the original turbine and project element layout. Turbine 11 is in the middle. Do I have a laser pointer? I do. That's turbine 11 there. As you heard from Terry Bennett earlier, we moved turbine 11. That avoided impact to the core Bicknell thrush habitat, as well as minimizing impact to subalpine fir habitat. And we could go to the next slide. This shows you how we moved turbine 11, as well as the associated road. Let's go to the final slide. That shows you the final layout, how we've moved it out to the outside of that habitat. And then if we could go to the final slide, this just shows you the entire mapped subalpine fir community. And I'd like to now turn it over to Don Hudson, who's going to talk to us in greater detail about that community.
Good morning. My name is Don Hudson, and you have my pre-filed testimony as well as my CV. I currently serve as the president of the Chewonky Foundation in Wiscasset, and I'm here to testify as a private individual. I have a good deal of experience in forest ecology and alpine biology and ecology, and specifically the plant biology and ecology of mountains in Maine and similar areas in the subarctic and Arctic. I have conducted inventories in search of original undisturbed forests in Baxter State Park, the Bigelow Preserve, and the Mahoosuc Range. That work also included the survey and documentation of subalpine forests and alpine areas, which I mapped for the old Critical Areas Program in Baxter State Park in 1984 and Bigelow Preserve and Mahoosuc's in 1985. In preparation for my testimony today, I have reviewed the application of TransCanada for the Kibby Expansion Project and have viewed the area proposed for development. As I mentioned in my pre-filed testimony, based on a review of the application and my visit, and in light of my experience in the mountains of Maine, I do not believe that this forest is particularly fragile or at risk of significant widespread disturbance as a result of the activity proposed. This forest community is consistent with others in the Boundary Mountains that I inspected in 1994 and 2007, which have persisted for thousands of years since deglaciation and notably during the past 75 years of intensive forest management. Based on data from the Maine Natural Areas Program, there are approximately 40,000 acres of mapped subalpine forest in the state of Maine, roughly three-quarters of which I mapped. The highest value forests, of course, are the large tracts located in higher elevation areas such as the Mahoosuc's, Baxter State Park, Reddington Pond Range, and the Bigelows. Thus, the Sisk subalpine forest of 358 acres represents approximately 1% of the total mapped forest community in Maine. Importantly, although the community is considered rare in Maine, it is certainly not rare regionally or globally. The subalpine forests of Sisk Mountain are near the southern range of the forest type in the northeastern United States. The vast majority of this forest type north and south of us in Maine and New England is permanently protected. The subalpine forests in this slide, do you have the list with the... Yeah, just leave that up. The subalpine forest in this slide meant to show you one that shades in green. Those lines on this graph in front of you indicate that 91%.
Which photo? Just this one?
Yeah, just photo of the community, both photographs of the community of SIS.
We have a simple photo we haven't had a chance to walk down to it.
So the issue one is that.
This is directly responsive to Dr. Publicover's pre-filed testimony. And there are photographs. You can certainly cross-examine somebody on the photographs if you're concerned about it. Well, with all due respect, you didn't seem to have any objection to you providing new photographs to the commission for the first time.
That was a demonstrative exhibit in the opening statement. I was not planning to offer it as an exhibit in this proceeding.
TransCanada, what Juliet Brown has said is that these are rebuttal exhibits, that these are in response to testimony from Mr. Publicover. Do they appear relevant to you, to testimony that's been provided by Mr. Publicover? Gwen, it's your call. I mean, whether or not these are...
If it gives you any greater comfort, we're certainly willing to have these be demonstrative and not introduce them into the record. It is a key topic of discussion, and I thought it would be helpful for the commission to actually have a visual of what Dr. Publicover's testimony is about and what Mr. Hudson's testimony is about.
I'm just concerned about setting a pattern here where exhibits one after another that we've not had a chance to see before are suddenly being sprung on us during this direct testimony summary.
I'm saying that the objection is a fair one to make. I mean, the pre-hearing order was clear that the exhibits were to be pre-filed. However, there is an opportunity for parties to bring additional impeachment exhibits or rebuttal exhibits, which is what Ms. Brown is stating this is.
Is the timing of presenting these an inappropriate part of what is being happening here? Is this the timing? I mean, if these were brought in later, during the rebuttal.
You could, Gwen. You could reserve your ruling on them if you want to wait and give the consolidated parties an opportunity to question the witnesses on these exhibits during cross-examination. You could do that.
Okay. I think that's what I would prefer. I don't like setting a precedent here, certainly, of introducing them when then you haven't had a chance to take a look at them.
So, Gwen, my recommendation is, why don't you set them aside for now? These two photos are not exhibits, and you can take it up when this testimony is presented.
Okay, to carry on? And I think the words will speak for themselves. The illustrations can come later. If I can find my place. As one moves north in Canada and around the northern hemisphere, this forest type becomes more common and widespread in the mountains. Significant subalpine forests exist in Quebec, Newfoundland, and Labrador, for example. Additionally, the subalpine forest on Sisk is not one of the more special examples of the community type in Maine. The most important and critical examples of subalpine forest communities in Maine are the larger examples found in such places as Baxter, the Bigelow Range, and the Mahoosics, or along the intervening mountain corridors followed by the Appalachian Trail, where steeper grades, associated outcrops, and exposed ledges support thinner soils in particular. The topography of the Boundary Mountains is different from these other areas in meaningful ways, and as a result of these differences in topography and substrate, pure stands of subalpine forest are limited to the highest elevations in the Boundary Mountains. On the nearby Bigelow Range, for example, subalpine forest appears as low as 2,500 feet on the upper slopes of the ridge. In the Boundary Mountains, pure stands of subalpine forest are not limited to Kibby Mountain, Kibby Range, and Sisk. We know of other areas of the community that are not mapped, including but not limited to Mount Pisgah to the west, an unnamed mountain, the D-Series, Caribou Mountain, Number 6 Mountain, Merrill Mountain, Smart Mountain, Moose Mountain, and Tumbledown Mountain to the north, Snow Mountain, Onion Hill, Boyle Mountain, Cow Ridge, Boundary Peak, and Whitecap Mountain to the south. When considering the percentage values of subalpine forest in the Boundary Mountains, consideration should be made of that portion of the forest type that has not yet been mapped. I suspect that the total acreage of subalpine forest in the state might increase by as much as 20% if more modern and accurate techniques were employed in place of the simpler and more crude techniques that I employed 25 years ago. In summary, it is my estimation that the activity proposed in the application of TransCanada for Sisk Mountain will not threaten the integrity of the upper elevation forests of the Boundary Mountains, nor put at risk a fragile ecosystem ordinarily associated with mountaintops in Maine. Geological and topographical features that help to define the PMA in Maine, talus, buttresses of outcrop granite, and rocky barren summits, are not common in the Boundary Mountains. The forests associated with the upper slopes of these mountains are more mixed, pushing the lower end of pure balsam fir subalpine forest to 3,000 feet. The disturbance associated with road building and construction of towers has been minimized by the applicant and is not out of scale or keeping with the sorts of natural disturbance that this forest has survived over the thousands of years that it has been on Sisk Mountain. When I went to the top of Sisk, for example, I walked through an area of about a half an acre that had been completely altered by an overwintering moose, the trees dead and fallen over, and a natural succession of plants beginning to appear on the forest floor. On the other side of the ridge was a larger patch of wind-thrown trees, likely tipped over as part of a storm event sometime in the past 10 years. Despite these natural disturbances, which have produced the sorts of edge effects described elsewhere in the testimony before you, the plants and animals that make up this subalpine forest community have persisted on Sisk. Although there is less evidence of past human disturbance within the subalpine forest on Sisk that in some circumstances might compel me to recommend against development, in this case, I am drawn to a different conclusion. First, the nature and character of rarity of the forest type present on Sisk influences my thinking about this subject. As noted earlier, the community present on Sisk is not an especially critical example of the community in Maine, as it does not share some of the attributes of other high mountain plant communities that include rocky slopes and greater plant diversity, in particular due to the mingling of alpine and subalpine communities. Second, when considered regionally, this subalpine forest community is not particularly rare. Third, the project will only impact 39 acres of the mapped community, and while there will be some acres of impact associated with fragmentation and impacts on the edges of the project footprint, the collective impacts, direct adjacency and fragmentation, shown on the plan will not result in an unreasonable adverse effect to the plants and animals that make up this community. The presence of a road or other break through the forest will not significantly adversely impact the plant community, as it is very well adapted to regular and sometimes dramatic natural disturbance. This forest type can and does persist in small, discontinuous patches that are governed as much by topography as climate. Indeed, there are many examples of natural breaks in subalpine forests that do not adversely impact the overall forest community, although I recognize that in some instances there will be impacts from natural or man-made breaks on the wildlife community. My conclusion that the project will not result in an unacceptable impact to this community is also consistent with how the state has characterized the significance of the community generally and the potential impacts to the community from wind power development. Specifically, the state describes the community as follows in its comprehensive wildlife strategy document. It is dynamic and cycles through periods of damage and regeneration. It is relatively stable in overall extent and is extensive on Maine's higher mountains. Major occurrences are well protected within public lands or private conservation lands, and recreation and wind generation could locally degrade other minor sites, but these uses are unlikely to present a significant threat to the integrity of these forests. Finally, we cannot ignore the relevance of an impact of climate change on global environments, where conditions prevail in Maine to develop renewable energy with the least impact to natural communities and human communities alike. I believe that we should move with all expedition. The Boundary Mountains is just such a place.